Apart from the divinatory arts and astrology, there are, of course, a number of disciplines in the Middle Ages that contained elements of prognostication, including, for example, medicine and meteorology. Like divination, medicine and meteorology are concerned with predicting future events, such as the course of an illness, the weather for the future, and especially for agriculture. Whereas medicine and meteorology eventually established in the Latin West as sciences, the legitimacy and efficiency of mantic disciplines and of astrology was for centuries the subject of controversy. This development, as is well known, ultimately led in the Latin West to its exclusion from the Ordo Scientiarum. There's certainly a number of explanations of reasons for this exclusion, of which the most prominent ones so far, or the most studied ones, have been legal aspects, theological aspects, moral aspects, which have to do with mantics and with astrology. In my contribution, in my paper lecture this evening, I would like to focus, as has been said, and as is clear from my title, on a different aspect, namely on the epistemological status of the divinatory disciplines and of scientific prognostication in the Middle Ages, and the impact or the importance that it had for the development of these disciplines. My aim is to explore how prognostic disciplines established themselves within the medieval system, so the disciplines of prognostication in the large sense established themselves in the Middle Ages as sciences according to their inner logic. The starting point of my discussion is a survey of medieval terminology pertaining to the theory of knowledge and science used to describe the divinatory arts. I will focus on close connections between the development of this vocabulary, the one that is used for the mantic arts, and the development of the epistemological vocabulary used for medicine and for meteorology. I will show that the strictly parallel description of the prognostic sciences, this will be one of the outcomes which you will see, all the prognostic sciences are described in the Middle Ages from an epistemological point of view, strictly parallel, that this strictly parallel epistemological description meant that the theoretical requirements for medicine and also for meteorology as far as prognostication is concerned were also applied to the mantic disciplines. The introduction of these conditions marked the beginning of a more differentiated, I would argue, interpretation of the prognostic disciplines within the philosophical discourse. And I come to my first subsection, which I called From Divine to Human Knowledge, a text which is crucial for studying the mantic disciplines in the Middle Ages, and which you all may know, is the discussion of the magical arts, which the 6th or 7th century author Isidore of Seville included in book 8 of his Etymologiae. The following sentences are particularly significant regarding the epistemological assessment of these disciplines. And I quote from Isidore. It's on your handout, it's in the full version. Necromancers are those by whose incantations the dead, brought back to life, seem to prophesy and to answer what is asked. Necros, for necros, means dead in Greek, and manteia means divination. Diviners, in Latin divini, are so named as if they were filled with God, in Latin deo pleni. In this chapter, or in this passage, Isidore thus describes the concept of divination, which defines its cognitive mechanism in such a way that distinguishes it clearly from human knowledge. Following Cicero and his De Divinatione, Isidore uses, as you see in this quotation, divinare for the mode of cognition among augurs and astrologers, the etymological explanation which he gives being that these people are deo pleni, that they are full with God, so that they allegedly partake in divine knowledge, which elevates this kind of knowledge above the limits of natural knowledge. Accordingly, since this is a non-natural knowledge for Isidore, accordingly, Isidore qualifies this knowledge in the following passages of his Etymologiae as ars demonum, so it's demons and devils' art. Because it's not natural, and it alleges that it partakes in divine knowledge. This epistemological terminology survived in particular among the critiques of the mantic arts in the Latin tradition, from Rabanus Maurus in the 9th century to Hugh of St. Victor in the 12th century. They all speak about divinare and thus classify the mantic disciplines as suprahuman modes of cognition. By the middle of the 12th century, however, the reception of Arabic texts on philosophy and science led to an epistemological reappraisal of the mantic arts. This new account of their epistemological status can be found in texts known as introductiones or introductions to philosophy, which replaced the earlier encyclopedias as Isidore's Etymologiae or the monastic manuals like Hugh of St. Victor's Didascalicon. The first of these texts deserves mention here, and Klaus Harris has already said that I've been working on this author, so it's kind of compulsory for me to speak about this author, is the De Divisione Philosophiae by Dominicus Gundisalinus. Composed around 1150, this treatise represents the first attempt to synthesize Arabic Aristotelian learning and Latin Christian thought. Gundisalinus discusses the predictive arts in several passages of this work. One of them appears in the chapter on mathematics and is crucial for the present purpose. Gundisalinus writes about astrology, and I have to apologize because I was here 2 years ago and I spoke about the same passage, but now I will say something completely new about this passage. So even those who were at my talk 2 years ago will, I hope that they will agree that I'm saying something new. It's a longer quotation. What it is, astrology, is defined in the following manner, Gundisalinus says. Astronomia, and he inverts, that's a classical inversion which is known in the Middle Ages. When he speaks of astronomia, he refers to what we would call nowadays astrology. No? So astrology is the science which describes the course and the position of the stars according to the opinion of the people, secundum hominum opinionem, in order to obtain knowledge of the auspicious moment in time. Its genus consists in being that science which decides a question presented to it, de proposita questione, namely whether it is an auspicious moment in time to do whatever one has to do, based on the position of the planets and the constellations. Even though there are many sciences of judgment, he says, scientia judicandi, for a given question, de proposita questione, such as geomancy, which is divination according to earth, hydromancy according to water, aromancy according to air, pyromancy according to fire, chiromancy according to the hand, and many others, even so there are many, astrology is more noble than the others. This description makes a clear contrast, I would like to argue, with the classical definition of the cognitive mode of prognosis as suprahuman, as a suprahuman form of knowledge. Concerning astrology, Gundisalinus stresses that it is knowledge secundum hominum opinionem, that is, based on a purely human act of cognition, which corresponds to an opinion. Apart from using the expression opinio hominum, Gundisalinus explains that this opinion-based science allows answers to questions which are more or less spontaneously presented. De proposita questione in the Latin text. With this, I argue, or I suggest, he moves the prognostic disciplines into the proximity of topical knowledge. Since Aristotle established in the topics, topics 1-1, where we have all the data on the handout, or in the paper, Aristotle established that it is one of the characteristic features of topical knowledge that it starts with opinions, with assumptions, he says, which are, and this is a direct quotation from Aristotle, which are accepted by all, or the majority, or by the most notable and illustrious of them. That is, topical knowledge, different from demonstrative knowledge for Aristotle, begins with the opiniones hominum, with the endoxa, as he calls them, which are applied, and this is also Aristotle, which are applied to every problem propounded to us. Gunisalinos confirms such a cognitive framework, a topical framework, when he qualifies the arts of prediction in his theory of science as scientiae judicandi, which was also which you also heard in the quotation, which is a term that was usually used in the logical tradition up to the 12th century with respect to the topics. Hugo St. Victor, to quote again his contemporary, for example, stated in his chapter on logic that the scientia judicandi allows to judge on the two parts of a question. This description of the mental arts within the theory of knowledge and science remained influential in the 13th century. Thus, the introductions to the concept and subject matter of philosophy, which were composed, for instance, at the University of Paris in the 13th century, still used this approach. A single glance into one of these overviews of the various disciplines taught in the university, the anonymous Philosophica Disciplina from approximately 1245, confirms the relevance of this approach, which is put forward by Gunisalinos. In the chapter on astrology, the anonymous author reproduces literally Gunisalinos' definition of the cognitive mode of prediction as secundum hominem hominum opinionem, as well as its status as scientia judicandi. While the reappraisal of the arts of divination located them clearly within the horizon of human cognition, so we shift, in Isidore it's clear that the mental disciplines belong to the suprahuman realm of cognition of knowledge. With Gunisalinos, it becomes clear, or he wants them to be part of human knowledge in the sense that they are topical knowledge. So while this shift from supra to human knowledge is important, it implied also that these disciplines were not, strictly speaking, demonstrative sciences in the Aristotelian sense of the word. That is, they do not operate through causes, through causal relations and with necessity. They were rather concerned with, as Gunisalinos says in passing, significationes. The first, so let me just try to summarize even more what I've said. In Isidore, we start with an approach which addresses mental disciplines as non-human disciplines. In Gunisalinos, he shifts the focus to human disciplines. At the same time, he says, well, or he seems to say, and you can discuss this later on, he seems to say to me, they are topical forms of knowledge. Topical forms of knowledge. So it shifts from divine knowledge to human knowledge, and within human knowledge to topical forms of knowledge, which means they are not sciences in the strict sense, in the strict scholastic and Aristotelian sense. In the course of the 13th century, and I come to my second subsection, which I called Semiology and Scientia Conjecturalis, in the course of the 13th century, authors further developed the idea of the mental disciplines as natural forms of cognition. In particular, as a relation between divination and medicine was established, a more clear-cut picture emerged. This had implications for both the specific cognitive mode of divination as well as the definition of its scientific status. First of all, one can observe that the mental treatises, as well as philosophical literature, more generally speaking, start using the term prognosticare and prognosticatio to capture the specific kind of cognition of the disciplines of divination. The impact of this term, which Latin authors knew, again, from Isidore is a source for lots of conceptual notions in the Middle Ages, became even more influential, the concept of prognosticare and prognosticatio, with the translation of Hippocrates' treatise on prognosis, which entered the authoritative collection of Latin medical texts during the 12th century. To present one example of the philosophical tradition and how the term prognosticare is used, I quote a treatise called Divisio Scientiarum by a master from Paris, Arnold of Provence, written about the mid of the 13th century. Concerning the division of romantic arts, Arnold explains, and again, this is on both handout and text, there are five kinds of divination: pyromancy, aromancy, hygromancy, geomancy, necromancy. Pyromancy is conducted in fire or a burning candle, where images appear. Hygromancy is conducted in the water, where images appear, which old women use in order to prognosticant, death and whether it is going to occur in the near or far future. With prognosis, with the term prognosis or prognosticare, Arnulf clearly introduces vocabulary from medical theory in order to describe the mode of cognition of hygromancy, which is also connected here with an event which is of course relevant for medicine, namely death, whether death will occur in the near or the far future. This is the object of the prognosticatio. The close connection between the epistemologies of the romantic arts and of medicine is particularly obvious in another 13th century author, namely Albert the Great. In his discussion of romantic arts, Albert refers time and again to the physician and to the physician's prognosis, which he usually introduces in a comparative manner, speaking about astrology or speaking about the mantic discipline, saying, sicut medicus, and then he goes on, astrologos does this and that. For Albert, the explanation for this epistemological entanglement of mantic and medicine was grounded in the fact that both disciplines were concerned, at least in part, with signa and not with causae. Both medicine and mantic disciplines, as well as astrology, are concerned, he says, from an epistemological point of view, not with causes, but with signs. Although this idea is actually already present in Nietzsche in Mundi Salinos, and I've alluded to that saying that he speaks of significationes, it is Albert who discusses in much greater detail this entanglement and with respect to its epistemological implications. In the following passage, Albert analyzes the decisive difference between the causae on the one hand and the signa, means the causes and signs, on which prognosis is based, on the latter, on the signs, in the following manner. A cause, he says, is something the being of which is followed by something else. A cause is something the being of which is followed by something else. Hence, the stars can be signs for wars and voluntary actions, but they cannot be their causes because they do not follow in a causal way, in the sense that a human's bodily condition somehow moves his will towards impulses and passions. Thus, the physician, this is what I told you before, he introduces the comparison with the physician. Thus, the physician explains in a comparable manner that a beneficial mixture of the fluids in the organism points to positive habits, whereas an unfavorable mixture points to negative moral ways. Likewise, the physician states that melancholiacs are envious and unreliable and do not keep their word. These signs, signa, are often fallible, he says, fallibilis. In this analysis, there exists actually no difference between the epistemologies of the mantic arts and of medicine. Both consider in their prognosis signs which eo ipso do not reflect natural causal relations. Rather, the difference between mantic arts and medicine would be a gradual one, since Albert says, while the physician bases his prognosis on an immediate sign, per signum proximum, the astrologer does this with the help of a distant sign, per signum remotum. So both operate with signs, differently from many other disciplines who operate by means of causes. And within focusing on signs, the difference would be rather a gradual one. Consequently, according to Albert, mantic arts, medicine, as well as meteorology, all partake in the mode of cognition specific to semiological prognosis, because they interpret signs, rather than in the mode of cognition concerned with causes. In the context of this theory, these disciplines form a separate category, which Olbert summarizes under the heading of Scientia Conjecturalis, Scientiae Conjecturalis, Conjecturalis. Like prognosis, this concept has its roots, again, in medical theory, namely in Celsus, in the physician Celsus. The nature of the Scientia Conjecturalis is a scientific category, Olbert says, sui generis, which becomes obvious in his classification of the sciences in a work called De Clinica Universalibus, where Olbert presents the threefold division of theoretical philosophy, which he calls real philosophy, which is not philosophia realis, he calls it, but it means theoretical philosophy for him. And he says, in the real sciences, in theoretical philosophy, one proceeds in one way in those sciences which are concerned with what is probable, and in another way in those which are concerned with what is necessary and enduring, and still in another in those concerned with conjecture. In comparison with Gunnisalinus' division into demonstrative and topical knowledge, which is the standard Aristotelian account, Olbert expands the Aristotelian theory of science by adding a third area, that of conjecture, which is a development, I won't go into this, but it has to do in part with the medieval understanding of the topics, since the Aristotelian endoxa, so the opinions which Aristotle alludes to in the topics, were translated by Bonifius with the term probabilis or probabilia. It was no longer a question of opinion-based knowledge, but probable knowledge. And there was a clear opposition between necessary, demonstrative knowledge, and topical, probable knowledge, whereas Aristotle would not have drawn such a sharp distinction because he did not want to exclude that topical knowledge could also be some kind of necessary knowledge. But since endoxa was translated as probabilia, so there was a clear opposition, and probabilia in this context meant that these events would occur ut in pluribus in most of the cases. Which is not the case, Olbert would say, with the mantic disciplines and with the interpretation of signa, which are, as he said before and as we've read, fallibiles. So he has to introduce a third category, which is the scientia conjecturalis. Olbert thus extended his classification of the sciences to include all those sciences which produce prognosis on the basis of science, adding the concept, as I've stressed, of the scientia conjecturalis, which comprises the divinatory arts as well as astrology, medicine, and meteorology. This conjectural science is neither identical with the strict idea of a scientia as demonstrative science, nor with the softer notion of science as a probable knowledge or as topical knowledge. It rather constitutes a separate mode of cognition and a separate category of science. Olbert says, and also this is on your handout, since conjecture is based on changeable things, it results in a weaker habit of certainty than scientia and opinio. So with regard to Gunnisalinus, you see clearly that there is a third way that Olbert introduces. It's not about scientia, it's not about opinio, but mantic disciplines have to do with conjectura, which he clearly defines as being less certain than scientia on the one hand and opinion on the other, which were both extremes of what was possible until then in scholastic epistemology. He says there's a third one, which is conjectura, and which is precisely the one for mantic disciplines and for medicine. It follows that for Olbert, the mantic arts are neither pseudo-divine modes of cognition nor forms of knowledge based on opinions, but rather conjectural sciences, which is a concept that remained influential in Thomas Aquinas, but even later in Nicholas of Cusa, who developed an entire theory, his entire philosophy on the concept, on a reinterpretation of the concept of conjectura. So when in the 13th century the divinatory disciplines were interpreted semiologically as sign sciences, along the lines of medicine, medical theory became the hermeneutical key used to define the prognostic sciences in general. With their effort to assign to the mental arts a place in the classification of the sciences, medieval authors recovered an interpretation which, even though they did not know, or only few, Albert may have guessed, can ultimately be traced back to Greek antiquity. In fact, Ptolemy had Greek-Roman antiquity. Ptolemy had already described the modus cognoscendi of astrology in his Tetrabiblos as eikasia, that is precisely guesswork or conjecture, and he does this relating closely to medicine. I come to my third and actually the last subsection of my talk, which I've called Scientia Conjecturalis and Ars Conjectandi. At first glance, this result may be surprising. Contrary to expectation, when medieval scholars carefully examined the epistemological position of the mantic arts, they did not draw the conclusion to exclude it from the category of science. We can rather observe that they describe it epistemologically in a more and more precise and standardized manner, notwithstanding all the moral and theological misgivings and the discussions about mantic disciplines which we can find in a theological and legal and moral context. At the same time, so first of all, a surprising result which I've already announced at the beginning, the mantic disciplines from an epistemological point of view are described strictly parallel with medicine, with meteorology, with other predictive sciences. However, one should not forget that establishing the epistemological commensurability between these disciplines set a kind of common yardstick. For when the mantic arts were described, were first of all detached from the numinous realm of pseudo-divine knowledge, which is beyond the reach of rational examination, and were placed among other prognostic disciplines, at this moment it becomes possible to evaluate and compare their concepts of prognosis. Crucial for this critical comparison is the specific development of the concept of prognosis in the various conjectural or semiological disciplines. For even though medicine and meteorology, with their predictions, may have been closely connected to astrological practices, there are decisive systematic differences too regarding the underlying theoretical concept of prognosis and its implications. In the medical tradition, as is known, it was Hippocrates who established the foundation for the concept of prognosis with his writings, Aphorisms and Prognosis, which emphasized precisely the semiological dimension of predicting the course of an illness. So they are very much focusing on science. These treatises, Hippocrates' treatises, were translated in the 12th century and were read through the optics, and this is important, of Galen. So Galen's texts, which were also translated, are of particular relevance for the development of the concept of prognosis, because in their reading, in their interpretation of Hippocrates, they emphasized new aspects. As I just said, Hippocrates has a very semiological approach to prognosis, and so he describes different signs, and that's at the core of his Aphorisms and Prognosis. Galen adds a new aspect, which is the theory of the critical days, with which he shifts attention from the semiological dimension of prognosis, from the signs that you can observe in the body, to the chronology of the prognosis. The critical days are a theory which aims at identifying those days which are crucial in the development of an illness, and which therefore are crucial for predicting the course and the outcome of that illness. In the course of the Middle Ages, the doctrine of primitive deities became increasingly important. I would like to give just one example, namely the physician Bernard of Gordon, who was one of the most prominent theoreticians of medicine at the University of Montpellier at the end of the 13th century. His Tractatus de Crisi et Diebus Critices, composed approximately in 1295, may be regarded as a direct result of medical prognosis, focusing on chronology, which is, as I've said, the crucial aspect. Bernard's diagnosis and prognosis of the pulmonary abscess may serve here as an example. Bernard begins by listing the initial symptoms: pain, fever, difficulties in breathing, coughing, and so on. So this is semiology. But semiology alone does not allow the prognosis, it just allows the diagnosis. Prognosis, rather, requires a detailed chronology, he says. Thus, Bernard writes, if white and digested sputum, spit, appears within 3 days of the beginning of the illness, accompanied by moderate coughing, then the illness is certainly going to be cured soon. If sputum appears later, then the illness is going to be cured later. If bad signs appear early on, such as yellowish, reddish, bluish, or green sputum, then it indicates an early death. If they appear later, then it indicates a late death. You're smiling, but it has some importance because there is the idea of a chronology, which is not just the science, but the kind of procedural aspect. And to amuse you even more, I'll give you the example of gastric abscess, where he states, in the case of strong initial symptoms, these abscesses lead to death. If they do not, especially if the patient is young and pain appears in the forehead and is accompanied by red blotches, then nosebleed is going to occur within 7 days. If this does not happen and the illness continues for 20 days, then it ends with pus. This kind of conditional prognosis, which is expressed, as you've seen, in the form of if-then, is present in numerous medical treatises of the time. It is crucial for the epistemology of the prognostic sciences, since it testifies to a development which leads from a holistic approach, from a holistic prognosis, which was also practiced partly in medicine, to a sequential and compartmentalized one. In this model, semiology alone is not sufficient for determining the course of an illness. We rather find here the introduction of an inductive chronology that is based on experience that conditions and controls prognosis at the same time. Changing scenarios, if this happens, if that happens, so changing scenarios make it possible to establish the prognosis with progressive precision and adapt it as need be. A graphic representation, and the historians of mathematics would perhaps not agree, but I dare to say it. A graphic representation of the adaptive prognosis might show a tree with different parts which can be used to assess the probability of the various courses and ends of the illness. This happens after 2 days, and then happens this, or then happens that, so you can try to draw up a kind of tree. The case of meteorology is, I would say, similar. Also, with regard to meteorology, there is, of course, lots of astrometeorology where astrological data are very important for forecasts. But still, I would argue that even in meteorology, an independent paradigm of prognosis developed, as is apparent in Al-Kindi's epistles on weather forecasting, which circulated in the 13th century in Latin. Translation that was also known to Albertus Magnus. As Charles Burnett has pointed out, Al-Kindi introduced in these texts a new principle into astrometeorological prognosis. What continues becomes stronger in its effect. So, according to Al-Kindi, the weather forecast for a period T1 determines the weather forecast for the following period T2, and so far as similar forecasts, he says, for two consecutive time periods T1 and T2 reinforce the effect in T2. This sounds very abstract, but it just means if forecast for spring is good and forecast for summer is good, it will be a very nice summer, or the other way around. It is thus obvious that prognosis in Al-Kindi's treatises have a similar form as the medical prognosis which I've just presented. Both use the if-then mode. And then I have some examples, but I don't know if you want to go. I can just read one of the examples, but it's what I've just said. As for the indications for the autumn quadrant, Al-Kindi says, one should examine the conditions in it and in the previous quadrant. If they are all retrograde in it, it is a sign of much dryness. If two or three planets are retrograde, the dryness will be less and three, and there will be more moisture like vapor, not like rain. If none of the planets is retrograde, the cold, frost, and snow of this quadrant will be extreme. And this is now a bit complicated, maybe to not necessarily go into it, but there is a strict correlation or connection between the two quadrants, which are for summer and for autumn in this case, and they condition each other. There is another prognosis, but it just comes out to say the same. A concept of prediction emerged within the prognostic disciplines that consisted of a cumulative interpretation of consecutive events. It is obvious, not least from the recurring expression, if then, that this kind of prognosis leaves room for adaptation which reflects its conditional probability. Obiit scientia conjecturalis, and I'm going to say again something which mathematicians won't want to agree, I guess, created, or one could say that it created within itself, the scientia conjecturalis, a space for Jacob Bernoulli's ars conjectandi, namely stochastics. It is precisely here, it appears to me, in a very crude sense, and I won't make a, not making a forerunner of stochastics of Marcus Marcus, but I think it's more than just a terminological coincidence that Obiit speaks of scientia conjecturalis, and this develops into future theories. So it is precisely here, it appears to me, that the epistemological foundation of the prognostic sciences differs from the mantic arts. For while the concept of prognosis was transformed from medicine and meteorology and developed from a holistic prediction to a sequential and conditional prediction, the idea of a global prediction, which is unaffected by the course of events, remained decisive for the mantic arts. It may seem that such an objection, or it may seem that an objection to such an interpretation could be raised with a view to the historical prophecies which flourished in particular in the Middle Ages. A colleague, a close colleague of Bernard of Gordon, the physician and lay theologian Arnold of Villanova, for example, discussed the oracle of the Erythrian Sibylla in De Tempore Adventus Antichristi, a work that he composed at the turn from the 13th to the 14th century, so strictly contemporary with this medical context. The oracle, he says, predicted not only Paris' theft of Helen, but every important historical, he says, event such as the arrival of Christ, the arrival of Muhammad, the expulsion of Charles of Anjou from Sicily, and so on. At the time of Arnold, only four events were waiting to happen, he says. The reunification of the Greek and the Roman churches, the end of Islam, the appearance of the Antichrist, of course, and the second coming of Christ. Since the Sibylla claimed that no more than 24 years would pass between each of these events, the end of times was going to take place in the near future, he says. So, why I'm saying this, because one could indeed claim that in such a prediction, prognosis also consists of sequential components, of compartmentalized predictions. In response to such an objection, one must argue, however, that the individual development and the specific form of each of these sequences does in no way determine the dynamics of the prophecy as a whole. Unlike the manner of prediction of the prognostic sciences in medicine or in meteorology, this prophecy does not allow for any adaptation to actual historical developments. It is rather the case that in this concept, history itself progresses straight towards its proper end. Furthermore, the division into sequences in this prophecy is, I guess, only relevant retrospectively. For Arnold, the purpose of the sequences is to use the apparently accurate predictions of events which have already occurred to show that also the prediction of future events is reliable. A compatriot of Arnaldo Villanova, Ramon Llull, presented an invective against the astrologers in a work that he calls Ars Scientiae, 1296. So we are always moving at the end of the 13th century. In this, he points precisely out the problem of this lack of adaptivity in divinatory prognosis. Llull discusses or narrates the case of an astrologer who makes a prediction for a king that within 1 year this king shall die. Of course, the king is very concerned, and indeed his health worsens every day because of the emotional stress and the emotional pain that he suffers from such a prediction. Fortunately, there is a knight who is a friend of the king who sees what is going on, and he tries to convince the king and said, well, don't take this too seriously, but the king is has no way of convincing the king until he takes the king one day to the astrologer and in the presence of the king asks the astrologer, you that have made this nice prediction about the king, what is the prediction for your own death? And you can already imagine what will happen. The astrologer says, well, and he looks into his data and says, I have 10 years at least to live. The knight takes out his sword and beheads the king. The astrologer. The astrologer in front of the king. And with this, the prophecy or the prediction that was made for the king is, of course, irreversibly refuted, gets a kind of cutting-edge solution. Arnold's prophecy and Llull's critical example give, from different perspectives, evidence for the following. Due to their specific mode of prediction, the mantic arts, at least the medieval mantic arts, I would say, do not allow for a conditional, adaptive prognosis and offer instead a global prediction that is unaffected by the course of events. Hence, they categorically exclude the possibility of integrating probability into the concept of prognosis, and they exclude the possibility to follow the model, thereby they exclude the possibility to follow the model of other prognostic sciences, such as medicine and in particular, and also meteorology. The extent to which the concept of conjectura became more precise and integrated a certain notion of probability had clear repercussions on a more differentiated classification of the prognostic disciplines. The mantic arts, which Olbert had presented as the conjectural sciences by excellence, eventually failed from an epistemological point of view precisely because of the progressive development of the concept, of the very concept of conjectura. Olbert, in a certain way, creates the category of scientiae conjecturales for this kind of knowledge, especially for astrology and for the mantic disciplines. And it turns out that in the progressive determination of what conjectura means, these disciplines lose, from an epistemological point of view, their justification, because they do not match the criteria of conjectura and of prognosis that are developed. So a comprehensive evaluation of the survey, which I've presented here, shows that the concept of prognosis as an epistemological category became more elaborate in the course of the Middle Ages. A new model of scientific prediction developed in particular in medical theory and also medical practice, as well as in meteorology. This new model permitted an integration of the conditional probability of the expected events, which allowed the option to falsify or at least to adapt and to revise your prognosis. Moreover, the particular attention paid in this model to the course of events contributed to a more detailed examination of the connections between the phenomena. Against the backdrop of this epistemological model of prognosis, which I've outlined, it is obvious that when the mantic disciplines were ultimately excluded from the Western canon of the sciences, it was not due alone to moral and theological concerns. The exclusion not only had reasons external to science and its development, but resulted precisely from developments within the theory of science in the medieval period. And with this, as you can see, your version of my paper, I'm at the end. Thank you.